So any other comments on that whole issue of freedom and being taken away? I think it makes a significant difference. And if it's true that an institutional religion tends to take that freedom away, then there might be a problem with institutional religion per se. At least there's a problem with institutional religion as we've seen it throughout history.
I don't think institutional religion sees that as a problem.
Exactly.
I think it's a goal.
It's a goal, right. That is the problem.
She's so smart. I'm glad I married her.
And I think as believers, maybe this dovetails with what Fred was saying earlier, we have to be very careful of becoming this way ourselves. Because if we believe that we have the truth, or know the truth, even if we recognize that we might not know everything perfectly, there can be a tendency to try to impose it on other people, to try to push and force people to think the way we do. And so there has to be a balance, I think, between sharing and inviting, and yet at the same time not limiting another individual's freedom that God has given them. Do you agree with me? What do you think?
Well, acceptance seems to be the carrot or the stick. If someone agrees with the group's thinking or about something, they get acceptance from the group.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, then they get
beaten with a stick.
Right.
Yeah, they get stick.
Ostracized, at
ostracized,
least,
yeah.
Or subtly looked down on, or something, yeah.
You know, peer pressure.
Right.
Plays a part in it.
So is that a problem?
Yes.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Even among believers?
Yes. I think it's a pretty big temptation.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, any group naturally tends to have that. So it's something that should be guarded against. Maybe it can't be completely eliminated. But. In any event, if Messiah didn't intend for us to set up institutional religions that would force people to think in a certain way, what did he intend?
To take us out of Egypt. Out of oppression.
Okay.
And to celebrate our freedom in God, and to, be aligned to other people, but not force ourselves on other
people. Okay. Yeah, and Passover, Pesach, is a celebration of freedom, of being set free from bondage, mm-hmm. where you were told what exactly you had to do.
A verse in Malachi about walking humbly with your God.
Mm-hmm.
Do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with your God.
Mm-hmm.
That's... Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's closer to what Yeshua intended.
Right. I think so. And there's a verse in Jacob, worship, or many translations will say religion, that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless as this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very active type of compassionate practice of life. That is what is considered to be religion in some translations. Now, even if you take it as religion there, it's maybe the only place where religion is mentioned in the Bible. And it's probably not a good translation. So religion is really not in the Bible, per se, in the way that we understand it. There are places that talk, of course, about worshiping God and certain things you're supposed to do as part of that, and so forth. And so some people would argue that religion is in there. And I think that's why on pages 189 and 190, you have a bit of a discussion of a few different words that some people might view as indicative of religion per se. One would be liturgia, which comes into English as liturgy. But in ancient times, it meant simply a work that is done in public. So it didn't mean the repeated use of a particular text the way liturgy does today. It didn't have to be only that. It could be that. But it simply meant some kind of work or service that you did.
That's direct from Judaism, Avodat Elohim.
Exactly.
Azara.
Right.
What's that?
Service to God or strange service. You know, two opposites. When you serve God and when you serve strange things, you know, they're like polar opposites. But the word is work or service.
Right.
You know?
Avodah, it's one of the most common words, I think, in Hebrew. It appears in the very beginning of Genesis. One of the reasons that God, well, it says God placed Adam in the garden so that he would work it and take care of it, protect it. But it's also used for the service of God, like the service that the priest did. It can also mean hard service, like the slavery in Egypt. So avodah is a very common word, but it means basically work or service of some kind. Working the ground, working to Pharaoh, working to God. And that's a kind of concept that is important to keep in mind for understanding these passages that are given here. For example, in Numbers, this is the work of the Gershonite clans. It's translated in the Septuagint as liturgia. So this is the liturgy. It doesn't really mean liturgy. It means this is the service that they're supposed to do. This is the work that they're supposed to do. And so in the middle of page 189, this traditional worship of religion is made complete in words, whether praise, creeds, or liturgy. So that's what completes it. That's what is the essence of it. In contrast, biblical worship, or avodah, encompasses not only the fruit of the lips, but also the overarching concept of avodah, meaning work, i.e. working for God. Certainly, the book of Jacob is a good one to read if you have doubts on that score. It talks a lot about the importance of works and not only believing. I don't think we need to get too much into that right now. But on the top of page 190, likewise, the Greek proskuneo, which is often translated as worship, comes out the same. It means to bow down or to accept the authority of another in one's life, in this case, the Lord. So, if you look at biblical terminology, just biblical terminology, not tradition that developed later in history, there doesn't seem to be the establishment of anything that we associate with religion today. The impressive institutional structures with their authority to command, set liturgies that are incumbent on everyone, set rituals that have to be performed with the permission of the authorities and so forth. This doesn't seem to be what Yeshua was attempting to establish, or at least he wasn't attempting to establish new ones.
Yeah, because with the tabernacle, a lot of things like that were
right.
God did establish some things along those lines.
Right, or the temple worship.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like there was any new set of rituals and religion that was established later. Okay, so leaving aside the terminology, let's move to Christianity is not Jewish. Potentially controversial statement on two levels, I think. First of all, it's a controversial statement to say that Christianity is Jewish, as Edith Schaefer did. And then it's controversial to disagree with that perspective. Yes, Vicky.
I was going to say, back on the liturgy issue, the two things in Christianity that seem like additions, like baptism and the Lord's Supper, communion.
Mm-hmm.
With the scriptures, immersion was already something that was practiced in certain ways.
Right.
So Yeshua, through John, seem to introduce another way of practicing it, or another reason to do it. Communion thing, he integrated that as part of the Passover meal.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was just using something that was already there in a different way.
Okay. Does this argue that Christianity is Jewish or it isn't?
You would offend a lot of people if you said that Christianity is Jewish.
Yes, why?
Especially a lot of Jews.
Because they're jealous. I mean, they, you know, the Jews aren't, you know, faded out. They're the ones, you know. I mean, the Christians are the ones that are, you know, inheriting all the Jewishness. But yet they're not Jewish. I don't know.
Okay.
I think I understand what you're saying, and that it seems like a major avenue to give rise to replacement theology.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But also because of what we said earlier about Christianity being a blanket term that covers both those who were walking in the faith and those who were walking in what they understood the faith was at that time, and those who were just exploiting it, they were doing things that weren't Jewish and were against the Jews. So it would be upsetting to call Christianity Jewish when a lot of Jews can look and say, they weren't helping us, they were doing quite the opposite.
Right. Yeah, I think it's going to be problematic because we have to, again, define what Christianity means and what Jewish means to us.
Exactly.
But what did Edith Schaefer mean when she said that Christianity is Jewish?
I think she meant that the Bible is Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And having read the Bible and seen how all of it's written by Jewish people and the roots and the basis comes out of Judaism, that it is very Jewish. And the more she read about it, the more she was thinking, this is very Jewish. And so that's why she was calling her belief in the Bible Christianity, because that's what she'd been taught.
Right. And I think it was an attempt to explain to many Christians who had no understanding of this topic that their faith, if they believed in the Bible, came from the Jews and was essentially Jewish. That if they believed in Jesus, they were believing in a Jewish Messiah who was prophesied by Jewish prophets. If they believed any of the things that were written in the scriptures, they were believing things that had been given to the Jews and to them through the Jews and so forth. So that's an important point. And the way it's described here is that her point was simply that faith in Jesus is Jewish because that is the only biblical context for such faith. Her point remains true today because the Bible has not changed. If there were a Christianity that was nothing more than life-defining commitment to the God of Israel, as confirmed by the Messiah of the Scriptures, then perhaps it could indeed be said that Christianity is Jewish. So why does my father argue here that Christianity is not Jewish, and that's not a good way of thinking about it?
Because he's using a broader definition
right.
of what Christianity is.
Exactly. Why? I mean, we discussed this already.
Yeah.
We all had different versions of what Christianity is. Why does he insist on the broader definition?
Because that's our understanding of it now.
Okay.
I guess
it's for some people.
Maybe he believes that that would be God's definition of it.
Maybe. I think he would say that God doesn't give a definition of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But
if he did, this might be what it is.
No. Well, he says in the next paragraph why. Even if such a Christianity were to exist, the problem is that after 17 centuries of an imperial religion bearing the same name, after countless Christian attempts to annihilate the Jewish people and any connection with them, and after almost unceasing Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, and evangelical theological denunciation of the Jewish people and what God has given to them, such an understanding of Christianity is not possible. History and language will not allow it. Certainly doesn't seem possible to most Jews, but I think having looked at the theological and historical realities to some extent, or at least having mentioned them, it's not only a problem for Jews, it's a problem for anyone who's looking at the entire situation. Does that seem to make sense or not?
Well, I think it was a time when the believers in Yeshua, the first century, were known by another name, were considered a sect of Judaism, before it was removed from there. It was like the Jews hated us because we believed, and then the Christians picked it up, and they hated us because we were Jews. And so it was like we had no place to go but this one little sliver of what we called our own. But I think because things have morphed over time and things do not mean the same thing today that they did in the time of the Messiah, that you can't ever bring the two together like that. Although often I think of the real meaning behind the prodigal son as, you know, the older son who stayed with the father mm-hmm. forever was like the Jews. And when the Christian son, the younger son, went out and did his thing and then came back, you know, and then they're like, wait a minute, you've always been with me, but, you know, these guys, they just came back. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like you're going to see the Christians coming back in a more messianic sense in many ways.
I think there's an article in Time this week about the Jewishness of Jesus. And it being one of the top 10 ideas lately that are spreading around the world.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right. You know, they're rediscovering it.
But I don't think that we should, I don't think that we depart from those who are true believers that are Christians. I mean, true Christians, I think, are true brothers, true faith. I think we believe in the same exact thing. We just have a different expression of it. And I think sometimes our expression is confusing, as well as sometimes their expression is confusing to us. But I think the real believers of Messiah, those who actually serve and understand who Yeshua is from his origin, I think they're clearly in the same faith that we are, the same faith of believers.
Right, and again, it's emphasized here that some of the greatest humanitarians and humanitarian actions have come out of Christianity.
Yep.
Some of the greatest servants of God and man, and some of the greatest servants to Israel, did what they did because of what their Christianity taught them.
Mm-hmm.
They produced some of the most beautiful events in mankind's rather ugly history. God produced in them works of great beauty and love.
Mm-hmm.
But again, these were the exceptions. And we've been talking about the Holocaust. If you look at the Holocaust, there were many, many Christians who devoted their lives to saving Jews because of their Christianity. And there were more who devoted their lives to participating with the Nazis and annihilating Jews because of their Christianity. So again, it's the two sides. So the point that's being made here is not, certainly not one of separating from Christians who believe or anything like that. It's a question of terminology.
Mm-hmm.
What does Christianity mean? What does it mean when you say it to most people in the world? And it means all of these things, or at least as you say it to various people, it could encompass all sorts of different meanings that would actually be accurate. And so why does this matter? Is it just a question of this word or that word? Probably not. Christianity did not add anything, at least not anything positive, to what God had already given to the world through the Jewish people. Originally, it wasn't. Originally, faith in God was not called Christianity. It did not provide a new savior or a new way to treat people. It did not provide new hope or new life. It did not provide new scriptures. All it did was provide a new name, a name which proclaimed separation from the Jewish people. In other words, the magnificent actions of these exceptional great men and women, and they were exceptions, were the fruit of their adherence to the God who made all things, a God who stubbornly remains the God of Israel. It wasn't because of a new religion called Christianity that they were able to do these things. So again, the separation between the religion and the official terminology and the people themselves. And so the upshot, the argument here, the title of Edith Schaeffer's book is not true. Christianity is not Jewish. Christianity is primarily a religious system birthed in the 4th century, one that has defined itself in opposition to the Jewish people for 1,700 years. Mm-hmm. All Jewishness has been removed from the major church creeds, mm-hmm. and so forth. And we could list all of the other examples. The New Covenant is made with the Jewish people in the Bible, but not in Christianity and so forth. So what do you think at this point? Is it worth making the distinction?
Between Jews and Christians?
Well, not between Jews and Christians, but between Christianity and biblical faith. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, what else do we call it if we don't call it?
Good point.
What do we call our faith
mm-hmm.
or our practice if we don't call it Christianity? Then what do we call it?
Followers?
Well, at the bottom of page 191, the scriptures do not give a name other than life to living as God says we should. There are occasional references to the way, i.e. the way of the Lord or the way of God, Derech Adonai. These are simple references to walking with God, a common phrase in the scriptures all throughout the Bible. The scriptures do not establish a religion. They explain what it is to live in obedience to and in harmony with one's Creator and Redeemer.
It's a very old question. It's like the question in the Renaissance and Middle Ages. What do you do? Do you protest against it and you divide yourself like the Protestants, or do you work within like some Catholics that have, they're real believers, that they're a very small minority too? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an old question. I think God uses both camps. Mm-hmm. Both the fifth column and the one from without, to change the world from within and without, he'll use both.
Mm-hmm.
There's no right or wrong answer what we should be. God should lead you, whether, it's probably healthier to be among, the from without, like in the group of, we won't call them Protestants because they defile their name too, but It's very hard to maintain a position from within as a fifth column, but it can be done. But if a lot of people failed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, you really can't even use the word Judaism either, because we're definitely not Jewish in that context. I mean, we may be ethnically Jews, or we may be Messianic in our faith, or we may practice biblical mm-hmm. Judaism, but the Jews have defiled the religion of Judaism as well, with all the Talmudic and Kabbalah and mysticism and stuff that goes on there as well. So we're kind of somewhere else. So where are we?
Mm-hmm. You have people that work within Judaism as that fifth column too. I mean, believers among that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have three different cases.
We may find more.
Yeah. Well, but even Judaism is not outlined in the scriptures, per se.
Right. Exactly right.
There's not a religion and a religious system. It simply says, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God.
It's a chosen people, not a chosen religion.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Vicki, I think I interrupted you.
Oh, well, just that verse that James wrote about true religion,
mm-hmm.
or whatever else it gets translated as. That's the only time it seems to be mentioned, or that something like that is mentioned.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think for us it's a challenge not to use the term Christianity, because it has based on, like, our traditions,
mm-hmm.
but the reality is that we have been studying about the term, and the terminology is not biblical. It doesn't appear in the Bible. So if we identify with Messiah, and if we want to follow his word, we should be more careful about what we use, how we speak,
mm-hmm.
And for me, it has been a conflict in terms of I have been a believer like almost all my life, but I didn't really I didn't identify myself in another way, just like Christian. I was a Christian, until we have been studying what the word says, and I started to share with the history Jewish club. And I started to read about the history books about what was going on, and I started to hear like what Christianity did against the Jews, you know. And at some point I was like, oh, I don't want to identify myself as a Christian, you know, because that wasn't what Yeshua, I mean, wanted to show to his people, you know? So I know that it's a challenge, like, identify ourselves as believers, as disciples of Messiah. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a good way to start and maybe make a little bit of influence in our world around, you know,
Does anyone feel excluded when someone talks about Christianity? Do you feel like you're not a Christian?
I don't. I mean, I do feel like I am a Christian when people are talking about it in an idealistic sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the Shaliach Shaul felt he was still a Pharisee well after he was a believer. He said, I am. This, you know, yeah. He didn't separate himself from what he grew up to be, and he was a witness to his own people, and he went to, you know, the Beit Knesset first, the synagogue, before he went to the Goyim. Mm-hmm. So he was still the fifth column, yet he exercised himself also as, you know, towards the Gentiles as well. Mm-hmm. So you have an example par excellence of, you know, being both that, you know.
All things to all people.
Yes, that's what he said too, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I felt like sometimes I'm in a room and there's a Catholic there and a Mormon there, and somebody mentioned Christian, it's like you can't even talk about it because it doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. Uh-huh. It's just so different.
Yeah.
I know when I listen to the radio and I hear them say Christians, I always like, wait, use the word believer, because believer is more inclusive. You know, it includes people that actually believe in Messiah.
It also includes cults.
Well,
it's anyone who believes anything.
Yeah, but you know, I'm talking about people who actually are believers in the true Messiah, as opposed to just the word Christian.
But then you also, I mean, Christian seems to have that one, that broad umbrella meaning to, mm-hmm. to most people. But if you say a believer, it always begs the question as to what do you believe in?
Yeah, right.
And then you can explain it a little bit more. And then if you tell them, you know, I do believe in Jesus, and they go, well, then you're a Christian. Well, so are a lot of other people that really aren't following. I should just say I follow, you know, and I follow the biblical way. And so they're like, oh, okay.
They still would love you in that category.
Right.
Because that's
but
their understanding
kind
of
like
the word.
After their eyes kind of glaze over. Yeah. They go, oh, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah. When people accuse me of being religious, mm-hmm. I correct them and say, I'm not religious, I'm a person of faith. And right. There's a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Hopefully they follow up and ask if you do it. Sorry on that.
I guess one thing that came to my mind, just seeing how in the book it picks up on Yeshua only referring to himself and his followers, like, he is the way, the truth, and the life, that it really kind of limits us in how we can identify ourselves, but I think in a way it does more of what God might intend, that we can't identify ourselves as a group of people by a name we create. Because if we use Christian, then we're in a room of Catholics and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, and they're confused as to whether we're with them or not. Or it's like,
definitely not.
But if we identify ourselves with God, it puts the focus on Him. So I remember someone bringing this point up in a conversation that I heard before, that it might have been divinely inspired, that we have our faith in a way that we're supposed to explain it so that it doesn't keep the focus on us, that we're people who do this, or we're not these people who did that, but that we follow this person, that we follow the God of Israel, or that we follow the Jewish Messiah. And I guess it's just hard to be able to find a way to say that to people, because people have such jingle-trained minds that you only have so much time to be able to get to answer someone's questions before their eyes do glaze, before they're like, okay, yeah, whatever.
They sign you off as a religious fanatic.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the category.
There's not word.
Thank goodness.
Here comes that nut with the Bible.
Well, partly to pick up on that, and partly to answer Bobby's question, Yeshua and Shaul, Paul, were not aware of what it would mean to be a Christian, apparently. When Paul was asked to give an account of himself in Acts 21, for example, he said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was as zealous for God as any of you are today. And he goes on to admit that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything that is written in the law, the writings, and the prophets. So that's how he described himself. I think that's an appropriate identification for a Jew who believes in the Jewish Messiah even today. I'm a Jew, and I believe in the scriptures that God gave to the Jewish people, and I'm seeking the hope of Israel, and believe that the Messiah of Israel is Yeshua. Now, admittedly, it's a little bit more difficult for Gentile believers in the Jewish Messiah after 2,000 years to know how to define themselves, given the whole history of Christianity. And I don't think that I have a single answer to that question. And I do think that each person has to seek God as to how God would have them respond in each situation, but also in general, how to identify themselves. But I would suggest for consideration just the one question of, honestly, what does Christian mean, if you use it in language? What does Christianity mean, and what does Christian mean? Ileana, if you go to Puerto Rico, if you go home, and you say that you are Cristiana, what does that mean to people?
Well, it would probably mean that I believe in Jesus. But it could probably mean, like, I believe in Jesus, Saint Mary. You know.
So it means you're Catholic?
Other saints? Or?
It could be Catholic. I mean, the term is used indistinctly between the people over there.
Almost everyone there would be Cristiano.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have anything to do with what you believe or don't believe.
Yeah.
It's just part of the society. Mm-hmm. And if you remember earlier in the book, talking about the speaker in Italy who kept talking about being a Christian this or being a Christian that, and the translator kept changing it to being a believer in God, and finally the speaker was so annoyed, and he said, well, why do you keep changing it whenever I say Christian? And he said, well, everyone here is a Christian. That doesn't mean anything when you say that.
Yeah.
To these people. Everyone in Italy is a Christian. What you mean is someone who believes in the Bible and tries to live it.
Yeah.
So in most of the world, that is what Christian means. It's a cultural thing, and it's something that is passed down. It doesn't necessarily even have to do with a specific faith, except in a very vague way. Yeah.
I was just going to add that to a Jew, a Christian is anyone who's not Jewish.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Many Jews think that. It's a misconception. Really? Yeah.
Well, they know about Muslims now, too.
Well, I didn't know about Muslims when I was growing up. You know, they weren't around.
They didn't really have this in Baltimore.
In any event, this is the last chapter of part one of the book. So what was the purpose of part one of the book?
Deconstruction.
Deconstruction of what?
Poor translations.
Erroneous structures. Erroneous structures of interpretation, of translation, of theology, and so forth that have been built up and have misled people in various ways. What's the purpose of part two?
Rebuilding the highway.
Rebuilding the highway. So a construction of something else that would hopefully be more accurate and more biblical, that would take the place of these misconceptions. just as in Copernicus' day, what he was seeking to do was to deconstruct the geocentric model of the universe, which was inaccurate, but which was held to be true by everyone and was enforced by the authority of the church. And once he had done that, to replace it with a model that he thought was more accurate in describing the true situation of the universe. So hopefully that's what will be done in the second half of the book. I just want to mention, though, that this issue of the terminology of Christianity is important as the final point of part one, because without abandoning that terminology and that ideology, that religious system, you can't go on to the new structure that's being built in part two. It's a structure that's being built independently of the previous structure that we've been discussing in part one. Any final questions or comments?
Can I throw one in?
Absolutely. You may throw in two if you like.
Two. Here's the first one. This is Colossians 1:18.
Do you want to read it to us?
Well, I'm not sure what you're reading, so I'll just let you read whatever translation or version. Or...
I got four of them confused wrong.
Pick one.
What New King James?
That's not one of the four that I have, unfortunately.
Well, I don't know what it's going to read when you read it, so I just thought I'd read it.
He is also head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything.
Mm-hmm. So is this a term that maybe needs to be looked at? Because outside of the word
body.
Words Christianity and Judaism, isn't the New Testament word the church?
Yeah, that was another chapter.
Yes. Yeah.
Body?
No, we didn't talk about body so much, did we?
Well, the body is a fairly literal translation. He kephale to somatos, the head of the body, like a physical body. So it's a physical analogy. But we did definitely talk about ecclesia, which...
And what did you do with it?
And kahal.
Well, that's a good question. Let's see who can give
who
a good...
Remembers?
Who remembers? I could certainly summarize what we discussed, but maybe someone else could.
The ecclesia and synagogue both are words in Greek language that basically mean gathering or assembly, something along those lines. They don't specifically refer to a religious gathering, because it could be a political gathering or, you know,
family gathering,
a club or family gathering. It could be any kind of gathering or assembly.
A municipal assembly, for example, is often called an ecclesia in Greek cities.
Mm-hmm. But it seemed like the emphasis of the Gospels, not the Gospels, but of the Epistles, was that the whole concept of the wall between Jew and non-Jew disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And that neither of those were to be the right name anymore. That it was the body of Christ that was about, and that the non-Jew was now part of the children of Abraham, and therefore it was not physical descent that made the difference. Mm-hmm. It was faith in God, and therefore the term was intended to obliterate the concept of ethnicity, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so to identify the Messiah with one group or one culture is what Paul was saying was gone. Mm-hmm. And that's why we lost the Greek and the barbarian, the Scythian, and everything else. And that the emphasis was no longer to be on where you came from, but on where you put your faith and your trust.
Wow, well, that's a whole series of comprehensive questions. I'm happy to take a shot at answering them, unless someone else wants to contribute maybe some material from that we've studied already.
It'd be more succinct if you do it.
Thanks for the vote of confidence. Well, thanks for the questions. I mean, those are exactly the kinds of issues that we've been considering in the course. with regard to church in particular, it was in chapter 4, a good church is hard to find. There's no church in the Bible. And the reason for the subtitle is, as Vicky was explaining, the word ekklesia doesn't actually mean church. It didn't mean that in Greek, and it didn't mean that in the Jewish Greek text of the Messianic writings, what Christians call the New Testament. This is very easy to demonstrate. It's easy to demonstrate for Greek as a whole by looking in a lexicon and seeing how the word is used in classical sources. And it's easy to demonstrate for the Messianic writings by looking all throughout the passages where this word appears, ekklesia. So, for example, the word ekklesia is used in Acts, is it 19? The riotous mob in Ephesus that wanted to kill Paul is a couple of times called an ekklesia.
It doesn't mean church.
It doesn't mean church. Right. It was a pagan mob that was angry that these people were teaching worship of the one true God, and they wanted to kill them. But it's termed by the writers of the scriptures an ekklesia. So ekklesia there is not translated as church by most translators. And the reason is because there was a conscious decision to sort of distort the text a bit. Whenever ekklesia appeared in a positive light, or a light that appeared to be referring to believers, it was translated as church, to give it a kind of institutional Christian identity. This was a decision, for example, made by the King James translators explicitly, and they condemned Tyndale, on whom they based much of their work, for not doing that, for not going with the ecclesiastical terms, but for being more literal, I think. Tyndale used congregation or assembly for ekklesia. Whenever ekklesia appeared in a negative context, as with this riotous mob, they gave it another word. So no one reading the translation would have any idea that it was the same word being used. It was covered over completely. The same thing, but in the reverse, with the word synagoge. The word synagoge in ancient times did not mean a synagogue, even though that's the word it gave rise to. It didn't mean, in other words, an assembly of the Jews. It just meant an assembly. You could have a synagogue of some other kind of people, a synagogue of merchants, for example. But in translation of the Messianic writings, whenever it referred to Jews, it was translated as synagogue. And whenever it didn't appear to Jews or couldn't be made to refer to Jews, it was translated by another word. So, for example, I think it's in Jacob or James, there's a verse that says, if a rich man comes into your synagogue and a poor man also comes in and you show favoritism to the rich man, aren't you making distinctions and doing something that God doesn't desire? I'm paraphrasing. But in that verse, the word used is synagogue. It's not translated as synagogue in most English Bibles. Synagogue is only translated as synagogue when it seems to refer to unbelieving Jews. So there it's translated by a more neutral word, like assembly or congregation. On the other hand, there's a passage in Revelation that talks about a synagogue of Satan, of people who say they are Jews but are not. Now, this one was translated as synagogue, and it became associated by the church with being the Jewish people as a whole. Even though it explicitly says it's talking about people who aren't Jews, it came to be the term of the church, the synagogue of Satan, for Jews. So there was a conscious decision with both terms to mistranslate and to cover it over. And it's something that you wouldn't know by simply reading the translation. You'd have to go deeper. Mm-hmm. So the question of the church, I think, is one issue that you are raising. The church is not a biblical concept. The concepts that are used in the scriptures are ekklesia and synagoge. And these are translations of Hebrew words, kahal and edah, that appear hundreds of times throughout the Tanakh or the Old Testament, in which God describes his assembly. And so if we want to understand God's assembly, which he continues to talk about in the Messianic writings, we have to also look at all those passages throughout the Hebrew scriptures that talk about God's kahal and his edah, his assemblies. So that's my basic perspective on the church. With regard to ethnicity and obliterating ethnicity, I don't think this was God's purpose. God identifies people in various ways, as human beings, and then the first division among human beings, male and female. Mm-hmm. another division between human beings, Jew and Gentile. Now, that didn't arise in the same way as male and female, the distinction between Jew and Gentile. God didn't look at Adam, humanity, and say, half is going to be Jewish and half is going to be Gentile. Instead, naturally, they're developed, I guess, from the Tower of Babel on, the nations, the Goyim, as they're called in Hebrew, the different ethnicities and categories of nations. And at a certain point in time, God was not pleased with the way the nations were conducting themselves. And so he called one man from the nations, Avram, and he said, I'll make of you a new nation, and in you all of the families of the earth will be blessed. And he gave a special calling to the Jewish people. So the Jews arose after the Gentiles. The Goyim arose first, and then the Jews. And the Jews are a much smaller portion of humanity than are the Gentiles. Now, this ethnicity does not change regardless of whether a person believes in God or doesn't believe in God, accepts the Messiah or doesn't accept the Messiah. And to use modern ethnicities or nations, we could say that an Italian who comes to God is no less an Italian because they come to God, or an American or a Chinese or a Vietnamese or someone from Côte d'Ivoire. They don't cease to be a member of that nation when they come to God. The same thing for a Jewish person. They certainly don't cease to be a part of the Jewish nation that God created. And in fact, according to Paul, it's in a sense even more important to understand that Jewish identity than to understand the identity of another nationality once you've come to know the Messiah. Just to refer to a couple of passages in Romans 9, Romans 3, I think it is, he asks the question, what is the advantage of the Jew? Much in every respect, first because to them were entrusted the oracles of God. This follows a discussion in Romans 1 and 2 about God's priority in doing different things. The gospel is to the Jew first and also to the Greek, or also to the nations. That's in Romans 1:16. Romans 2 talks about blessing and honor and glory to the soul of him who does right, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, and punishment and distress to the Jew first and also to the Greek of everyone who does wrong, because there's no partiality with God. So God's lack of partiality here in Romans 2 is not the annihilation of Jew and Gentile or the end of Jewish and Gentile identity. It's rather a continuation of it. And he treats them somewhat differently because he treats them as who they are. He doesn't expect them to be identical because he didn't create them to be identical. So the calling continues. And then in Romans 9 is where you have Paul's statement that he could wish himself to be accursed eternally, separated from Messiah and from God, for the sake of his people, if that would bring about the salvation of Israel. And he says in Romans 9 that they are Israelites to whom belongs the adoption as sons and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service and the promises, whose are the fathers and from whom is the Messiah according to the flesh, who is over all. So there he specifically identifies Messiah as coming from the Jewish people. So I don't think in anything else that he said he was attempting to abrogate that in any way. In fact, one thing we've discussed quite a bit here is the importance of the Jewishness of Messiah, something that Yeshua or Jesus himself emphasized in John 4, for example, talking to the Samaritan woman, saying that you Samaritans worship what you don't know. We Jews worship what we know, for salvation is of the Jews. And in a sense, he's making a play on his own name. His name is Yeshua, which in Hebrew is salvation. So he's identifying himself as salvation, as being from the Jews. And this seems to be important to God. Now, I don't think that this in any way contradicts the idea of a wall being broken down between Jew and Gentile. That's also something that's important. But the wall is broken down in terms of fellowship in the Messiah with the Lord above all. it's not broken down in the sense of there are no more distinctions between people. Because in the same passages where he says, in this regard, with regard to whatever he's talking about, there's neither Jew nor Greek. He also says neither slave nor free, neither male nor female. Mm-hmm. So he's not saying that we're no longer males or females once we come to believe. He's not saying that we're no longer slaves or free once we come to believe. He writes, he sends Onesimus back to Philemon as a slave because he had run away. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, he's not saying we're no longer Jews or Gentiles. He's saying that we have our identities, of course. I am a Jewish man. We have a Gentile woman. So we have different identities. But the wall of partition that separated us has been broken down. We can have fellowship together in the Messiah. So if you look at the earlier chapters of Acts, you'll see that originally Jewish believers in the Messiah did not want to eat with Gentiles because they thought they would be breaking God's covenant. They didn't want to go to their houses. They thought they would be breaking his commandment. And that has been broken down. We can have fellowship together. We can eat together. But we don't stop being who God created us to be. Now, Bobby said my answer would be more succinct. I think he was mistaken in that. But if you want to follow up in any way, please.
His father wrote the book.
Well, I already picked that up.
That's why we call him Dr. Gruber. No, but you know, it's like you came in the middle of the movie and had to catch up.
Well, it was a good review.
Yeah, well, it actually was a good review. And I think it makes us all stronger. Are there any other questions for Dr. Gruber? Or any general statements you'd like to make? All right.
All right. Thank you.